accession number 30279, reel 4.
You mentioned, obviously, that you weren't particularly concerned that it might be a deadly experience for you in the long run, particularly if you were caught. Had you thought that what you were doing, what you were involved with, was the potential destruction of ships which would cost other people their lives, potentially?
I don't really feel that really came into my thinking that we'd already had a fair idea of the of our enemy and how they played the war game. So I tell you what, there wouldn't be any sympathy, or as far as I was concerned. And
in relation to this early training period, you obviously mentioned some of the examinations, the tests, the trial, the mock operations. What were you actually learning? Presumably how to make a bomb, how to blow up a tank, whatever it might be. What were some of the things you were actually being taught?
Well, the skill of when you're using high explosive, you've really got to know what you're doing. So we were trained, and the explosive we used was what they call PE, plastic explosive, and it was just like plasticine. So you could carry it around as long as there wasn't a detonator. So you could have PE in your pocket if you wished, because it was completely neutral. But we had an ordinary detonator, but because obviously you always needed time to get away from when it went off, most of our timings were of the explosive was with what they call a time pencil, which was a detonator, and you crushed, when that was inserted, you crushed the pencil, which was glass, and the acid would eat through and then trigger the detonator. And they had a time, X minutes, and the time pencil was coloured, so you knew that, say, that one had 15 minutes or half an hour, or not long as that, but anyway, that was the idea. So yeah, we were quite skilled in handling high explosives. I'd make a good safe blower.
Might talk to you about that later. In relation to the experience of learning this craft, almost, you're also learning hand-to-hand combat, and presumably this is something that you weren't particularly, I mean, this is all something that you were used to. I mean, you just a young bloke from Perth.
Yeah.
But the learning of the art of self-defence, all of that sort of thing, was that something that you were...
Yeah, well, that was... though in ordinary army life, you might say, in the army regiment, you had physical training to keep you fit. But we were taught being unarmed combat, and we had very good instructors, and you learnt things that I can still remember.
Such as?
Well, they... forget about trying to, you know, really break someone's arm or anything. But you can neutralise a fella by just hitting him across the throat. In other words, and it's got a disastrous effect. Instead of trying to punch his head off, there's a chop on the throat. And they had a few other things, of course, you know, kick him in the groin or do something like that. But and they had all the movements of unarmed combat, which was quite good. Yeah.
Well, how is all of this affecting your confidence?
Well, I think that, as I said, you know, it doesn't make you bulletproof, but at least you are fairly well confident you, in your own. If you were confronted, you could at least look after yourself. Not that you wanted to get into that situation, but still, we had that training. Now,
had they talked to you at all about what had been learnt of the Japanese intentions and operations in the islands? Obviously, they'd taken Singapore, they'd gone through. We hear of New Guinea, the Kokoda Track.
Yeah.
Had you heard much about what was actually happening?
Oh, yes, we did. And yes, we did, and you know, I feel that we were looking beyond. The Japanese by this time had sort of had established themselves in all those places that you were talking about, Timor, and further up the island track. And about this time, we had more or less completed our training, which I suppose would be about 6 weeks. And we were formed into a party.
What was the main concern of your superiors in relation to the Japanese tactics?
Well, by that time, they really had established themselves into a garrison situation. They'd captured the territory. Then they had to police it, you know, the local population, and then defend it if they were going to be attacked, which obviously they knew they would be. And now, I think the basings of our units, or the Z Special Unit, was not to be going to do hand-to-hand fighting, but to go undercover and do as much damage or other targets that they selected for certain operations. Some may only be to seek intelligence so they could come back and report for future planning. When and where the Australian Army were going to, and combined with Americans, of course, attack. So instead of, I think seeking intelligence was probably one of the most important things in those days, because there was no other way of finding out strength of the Japanese on certain islands, or could you get support from the local natives, indigenous people?
Did this concern you at all, that you were going to go into the territory of the enemy? How did you feel about the whole situation at this point?
Well, feeling the unknown. I guess you just feel confident of your training and the party that's around you, the other operatives, all went through the same training, and just depends on what operation they've been selected for you to do.
So let's talk. You were being put into special units.
Yeah. Operation. Now, I think it was roughly about 10 of us, maybe, an officer, two. We were moved from Fraser, probably Flowen, I can't quite recall now, to Melbourne. And we went down to, I don't know whether we were actually told what we were about to do, but I think I'll put it in there. Now, the operation was called Starfish. And the operation was based on the fact that the American submarines out of Fremantle, which was the biggest submarine base in Australia, or Exmouth Gulf, had to go through the Lombok Straits to get into China Sea, etc. Now the Lombok Straits, they couldn't get, in those days the submarines couldn't get through submerged because of the currents. So they'd wait for a moonless night and go flat out to get through the straits. The Japanese on the some quite heavy artillery. I think they were about 5.5 or 6 inches. Guns mounted on the high side of these straits, and luckily they didn't have radar, but they could hear, so they'd fire away. Now the Americans didn't like that; you couldn't blame them. And so the Starfish Party operation was to go there via submarine and sabotage these guns. So just getting back now, we're back in Port Phillip Bay, and there's some old naval guns on the mouth of the rip, which goes into Port Phillip Bay, up on the high side, and they were going to be our training. So we would we'd operate from a camp in the bay, and I just can't quite recall the name of it now. But at night there'd be a work boat come down, and we'd get on with our foal boats, and we'd go down to the mouth of the rip, and paddle ashore, hide the foal boats, and then scale up the cliff, and dodging some guards that would be up there just to make the exercise, and put plastic explosive dummies on these guns. So we did that quite a few nights. I'll tell you one interesting story. It was a pretty dangerous area just paddling ashore, because if the tide was running out of Port Phillip Bay through the rip, it was, I suppose it'd be running at about 5 or 6 knots. And we lost a canoe, a bow boat. Fortunately, there was no one in it. That went out to sea. We finished the exercise, and of course, next morning the coast watchers saw this, what they thought was a canoe just bobbing off the seaside, the ocean side, and there's alarms going on and what have you. I don't know how they organised that, but someone obviously went down and made up a story and got it back again. when we finished that exercise, we were flown to Perth and camped at Garden Island, where was the going to be the jumping off post to get a sub to go to the Lombok. Now, we started to wonder why we were waiting so long. Now, this is, I'd like to go back a little bit now. The reason why we were waiting, that I was at a reunion in Melbourne many, obviously quite some time ago, I met a fellow at the reunion who was a Victorian called Laurie Black, Lieutenant Laurie Black. Now, he was one of the advance party. This is quite...
Continue. Part of the advance party.
Yeah, so in a reunion of a Z special in May 94, as I mentioned, Laurie Black said to me, look, you're a starfish. And he said, I was the advance party. And we were put ashore by an American sub. And he and three others had to do a recce on these guns and report back. Well, it didn't turn out terribly successful, unfortunately. And Laurie explained to me that two of the party got split. Oh, one got split, and they didn't see him again. And by this time, the Japanese had known that they were ashore, or there was Australian or whoever ashore. So they were on the run then, and there was a firefight. The other operator was killed, but Laurie Black and his mate got back to their little base that they had organised in case of having to get out. They were able to get a message to Darwin, and a Catalina on the arranged signal and date flew in, and they also sent a Liberator bomber to a bit of a detraction. They dropped a few bombs and they jumped into their foal boat and got out. And now you can imagine Lombok Straits, it's not like a lake. So I think they capsized or did something on the way out, and eventually the pair got onto the Catalina. Then he had to take off, which was pretty dicey because there was virtually a decent sea running. At any rate, he was able to do a remarkable job by not going into wind. He sort of took off. At any rate, they noted it was a great flying exercise.
So this is the reason that your mission was held up.
That's exactly what. And so I'll just finish with, they got back to Darwin, and of course then the they were debriefed, and we were back at on sitting on Garden Island. And while we were sitting there waiting for, we did the course of the SB, the Sleeping Beauty, which is a little canoe that goes underwater. And so then we found out that the operation was scrubbed. But while we were talking back at this reunion, Laurie said, "You got to thank me for saving your life." Well, he was dead right.
Obviously, at the time, you didn't know that that was the case. But no. You were talking about these other things, you know, the Sleeping Beauty and all this sort of stuff. Only a couple of months earlier, you'd just been a callow lad, sort of joining the army and starting to drive tanks, and now you're learning how to jump out of planes and parachute and self-defense. Yeah. What was it like to learn to parachute out of a plane, for instance?
Yeah, well, all those sort of... I only did one jump. It was a practice jump. So I was never in an operation that required to be parachuted, so that was, you know, brief. Mm. The underwater one was quite intriguing, this Sleeping Beauty, SB as we call them. They came from the SB was shipped out from England. They used them over there for sneaking into harbours and things, put limpets on. They were never operational here. But
describe how they operated. You've got a canoe that suddenly goes underwater.
Yeah. Well, it's a canoe. Looks like one in form. Small electric motor, propeller, all the same as a... with a little hydrofoil and a rudder, and the operator sits in it, and then he floods the tanks. There's a tank aft, and then it slowly submerges in a little tank forward, which you what you call trim. So when the SB sinks, you put water, you open the valve, fills the tank forward, doesn't quite fill it till the nose dips down. Then you turn the battery power, of course, you turn the power on, and away you go. And the idea that you go like a porpoise, because you're sitting in there, you have no periscopes or anything like that, and you've got your oxygen and your mask on, and you go along and you put the dive and you go down, and then when you want to come up, so you don't go terribly deep, when you want to come up, you put the hydrofoils to rise and your head comes up and you look around. Then you put it to dive again, so hence it goes like a porpoise.
Adventuresome stuff. I mean, part of the reason that you wanted to join was for adventure, and yeah. It sounds to me as though you're getting it.
Oh, well, there was a boom ship called the Karangi that used to raise and lower the boom in Fremantle Harbour. It used to come over every now and then and anchor in Kareening Bay at Garden Island. And that was our operation at night. We'd go out and put the limpets on. And I remember one night, these... SBs had a mind of their own at times, and I was alongside, down about, I suppose about, I don't know, about 4 or 5 feet, maybe 10, and the idea, you put the limpet on, and that was like on a broomstick roughly, and they've got, you know, very strong magnets, and they go to clamp on the side of the ship. And then you put two down, you put one there, and that was had Cortex, which was the method of taking the explosive charge to the other one. Put that on, and then I sort of went into a bit of a dive for some reason. So next thing, I'm under the ship, and I look up, and it's flat bottom. So I bob up, my sort of head hits the bottom of the ship, and I thought, this is not too good. And anyway, eventually, being night, I could see it was light on either side, and I looked around. So fortunately, I was able to get into a bit of a dive, and I got out on the other side. So it was quite an experience sitting there, peering around underneath the ship. At any rate, so we did quite a few of those. As a matter of fact, the Navy used to come over with some of their ships to. They used to be degaussed there, so you know, it wouldn't attract magnetic mines. And we'd slap a few limpets on the Navy ships, and they didn't like that because they have the guards and everything, and we'd be able to sneak in and do the job.